It's time for the one show that takes a look at business from a different perspective, the coaching perspective, with Master Certified Business Coach, Duck DeFeller. Hey, Duck.
Hey, Paul. Glad to be with you today, and welcome, everybody, to today's episode of the Coaching Perspective. Our guest for today is Kathy Guiney, president and founder of Yes HR Solutions. But first, before we get to Kathy, if you're listening to our podcast, where were you when we broadcast live? Well, if you are listening to the podcast, thanks for visiting our website, thecoachingperspective.com. Be sure to check out our archives for other shows from the past with some great guests. And speaking of guests, if you'd like to be on the show, we're always looking for coaches, CEOs, and HR professionals to interview. Just send me an email, doug@thecoachingperspective.com. Hey, and if you've missed any of our previous shows, you can either go to the website or go directly to where we archive all of our shows for the last 6 years, dgefeller.podbeam.com. Well, as we said at the start of the show, our topic for today is recruitment and retention. And our guest is Kathy Guiney, president and founder of Yes HR Solutions. Kathy, welcome back to the Coaching Perspective radio show.
Thank you.
It's been 2 years since we talked to you last. Mm-hmm. And our topic then was wait, don't go, the stay interview. And we had a lot of really good comments on that.
It was a really good topic, and I'm looking forward to maybe expanding on that today.
Well, we're ready. Any of you who want to go back and hear that show, it was October 2012. You can find it in the archives on the dgefeller.podbeam site. So, Kathy, before we launch into today's topic, catch us up on what's transpired in your business for the last couple of years, and refresh our audience's mind about just what it is that you and your company do.
I'll be happy to. Yes HR Solution was founded about 12 years ago, and with a prime purpose to service small to mid-sized companies with what we call go-to HR. And that's pretty much as simple an explanation as I could come up with. And it's an HR resource that has expertise in all disciplines that is the right resource at the right time when you need it, whether it's to add on to a project some extra set of hands, or whether it's to work with a CEO to design an HR department for a startup. We have expertise in compensation and performance management and a broad spectrum training. So we're able to offer very customized services. Small to mid-sized companies are sort of our love of life, and that's where we focus.
Well, you know, I can just speak from personal experience. I've had the pleasure of working with you where you were brought into a company when they were in between HR personnel, and that in between lasted longer than anybody planned, and you really held it together well. I haven't had the chance to work with you in starting up a new HR department for a small company. I imagine that's a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun because you are definitely, you know, designing something from the ground up. It has to be scalable. It can't just be right for that moment in time because startups have big visions of growth. So it has to be scalable, and that's the fun part. And it has to be user-friendly because they may not have a resident HR person for a while. So it has to be very easy to use.
Talk a little bit about what you mean when you say HR. Because, you know, I talk to some people and their mind goes to, okay, you're going to keep me out of jail by not violating any laws. And other people go to, oh, you're going to help me hire somebody. But I know it can be much broader than that.
And it is. And certainly those elements are in it, obviously. But it's really about helping the management, CEO or the HR manager, maximize the experience an employee has, being sure that their talents are brought forth, that they're happy, they stay, and putting programs around that, whether it's training or giving performance feedback or employee communications, being transparent on where the company is in its growth. Challenges ahead, how the employees can help, how do they connect to the company. All of those things fall in, and there's disciplines involved. Compensation, how do you pay people, right? Are they paid correctly and competitively? How do you give performance feedback? Is it just a form? Gosh, we hope not. We've all experienced that.
Yeah.
That hasn't been good. Training. What are you training on? It just can't be the newest and grooviest topic out there. It has to be relevant to what the problems are. So it's all of those things.
Do you think that the definition and the involvement of HR has gotten broader since maybe you started 12 years ago?
I think so. I think it's now looked at as a very viable business function. It's not just the back office people that sit there and have electronic files or hard copy files. It really is, front of the page, headline sometimes, because if you're going to, for example, do business expansion, you're going to want to lead with not only due diligence of finance and marketing and revenue, you're going to lead with HR. It's like, who are these people that we're going to? How do we engage them? So it really has become, front page news, if you will. It's no longer back office.
Well, in my own observation, I've really been pleasantly surprised at how often HR is involved in crafting the messages that are being delivered to the employees. That mm-hmm. there's sort of a default place to go, and how do we say this without it being misinterpreted?
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've mentioned you've been doing quite a bit of that.
Yeah, I've actually had the wonderful opportunity to do that not only domestically but internationally. And I had some trepidation going, overseas and giving what might be construed as a U.S. message. But at the end of the day, people are working. They're working for a purpose. They're working to provide for their families, and they want to improve themselves and feel worthy. And as long as you touch on those, I don't know, as the culture doesn't need to be a stumbling block. It can work to your advantage. I think you have to educate yourself before you go and talk to a foreign audience. You need to know some of the do's and don'ts, clearly. But the message is pretty much the same. People all go to work for the same reason.
You mentioned a word that sort of I mentally went off on a sidetrack there. I have to ask you about it. I hear the term culture being talked about so much in companies. And the issue is, do we inherit a culture? Do we create a culture? Can we change a culture? Tell me a little bit about how you look at the term culture.
Well, I wish I could come up with another term. Maybe you and I could do that right now, Doug.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
but because it has gotten so fuzzy around the edges, I'm not sure what that word was supposed to mean. I think a culture is about what the company produces and how it does so. And if it's going to do that with an engaged population, what are the behaviors that create that? I guess that's culture, but it is has to be sustained. It's created, first of all, and then it has to be sustained. And it's a very precious thing, because every time you bring someone new in, they have the influence and the power to change it.
That's interesting, because companies tend to want to think that, okay, our culture, this is what it is, and it's static, but it isn't.
It's not.
It's at risk for good and bad changes every day.
And that's why, when companies hire, that certainly hiring for skills is important, but in some cases, hiring for potential, if you can train someone, but they're an awesome fit for your culture and where you want it to go and how you want to sustain it, might be a better hire.
I haven't used the word culture that way. The word I've always used is attitude. I've always said, we hire for skill and we fire for attitude, meaning
right.
that we're very good at assessing somebody's skill sets. Don't usually make a big mistake there. But we aren't real good, most of us, at assessing a person's attitude. Maybe culture is the word, but I want to say attitude. In the interview process, and later on we find out their attitude doesn't fit with the rest of the people in the company. Now that's culture, isn't it?
Or as people call it, the fit. They just don't fit.
Yeah.
And that's what they're talking about. And you're right. In the interview process, it's hard. It's hard.
I ran across an article, or it wasn't an article. I was looking up something on the internet just the other day and ran across a service that was touting use our online video audio service for your interviewing, and use it not just for your one-on-one interview, but use it for your group interview with as many as 10 people on the line. And I just shuddered to think that 9 other people are going to get on the line in a video conference to interview me. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
Well, I've heard of that. It's not anything I've tried, and I must admit I'm not eager to try it.
Okay, we're together on that.
Yeah, I would be very intimidated. If I'm a candidate, I would be extremely intimidated by that. First of all, I'm not a TV personality, so I'm not even sure how I would react to being, you know, seeing my face or seeing a bunch of faces. So I'm now in a little bit of a foreign sort of environment, trying to present myself the best possible. And I don't know, I guess I would have to see it in action. I don't want to dismiss it offhand, but it just seems impersonal. It seems like it probably is not putting the candidate or the managers. What do the managers know about being on video in a group of 9? You kind of go, wow, I'm not sure. I just don't know.
The staff meetings, the management meetings that I go to with 10 people are like herding cats. I can't imagine what it would be like in a technology environment. But, you know, that we'll get to where we were going to go if you don't mind. But
sure.
But how is technology being used today in the interviewing and the hiring process?
Well, you know, it's really interesting in that, you know, several years ago, it was all about how high tech can you be. And I've done it. You know, I have, you know, Twittered candidates, and, you know, you link in with them and you do Facebook and you do all of that stuff. You capture people on the technical side. The ATS systems, the applicant tracking systems, you know, all of those things are very tech, you know, they're high tech. And that was like the thing. And that's what we all did. Then it's starting to come maybe to a more balanced place where you capture people on the tech side because it's just easy. We all got our phones, and if I can send my resume to you over Twitter or LinkedIn, you know, I'm probably going to do that.
Initial contact is
initial
easier.
Contact.
I'd buy that.
Yeah, initial contact. Then we're sort of diverting back to old school, which is I'm going to call you now. Now you're going to hear my voice. And then I'm going to invite you in and you're going to see me in person. So we've sort of balanced this very, you know, low-touch, high-tech, instant connection with something that is more representative of what your life is going to be at work. You're going to be seeing people and you're going to be interacting with them. You're going to be on the phone with them. You know, so I think we have a need for that. I have found candidates to be much more engaged when they know that there's going to be an opportunity to see somebody.
You know, and I know you've seen this too, at the upper levels, let's say at the executive level, we tend to be willing to spend a lot of money in the interviewing and the hiring process, in the screening process. So they may come in for multiple interviews, we may have multiple people talk to them, we may invite them out to dinners and get them in different kinds of settings to see whether they're going to be, as we said, the right fit. But I don't see much of that being used anyplace else once you get out of that executive corner suite.
I think it just looks a little different. It has to be appropriate for obviously the type of candidate and level you're engaging someone for. But if you let's just take a staff engineer or an accountant. Certainly you could do the same sorts of personal attention by, you know, offering them a cup of coffee when they come in. Being on time for your interview, don't let them sit in the lobby because you've got one more set of emails to do. So perhaps it's smaller things, but they're still meaningful. I value your time, so I'm on time for the interview, I've already read your resume. I'm not going to read it while you're sitting in front of me. You know, it's those sorts of mm-hmm. respectful things that are really fundamentally no different than the attention you pay by taking someone out to dinner, right? You're still providing them with that, I'm paying attention to you.
And what's your rule of thumb as to, not that there is one, but how many people are going to interview this candidate. You know, I mean, I know companies that one person talks to them and that's it. I know other companies that they run them around and practically everybody talks to them.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the middle with that. I think there needs to be a balance. And I think you should have people interview that are going to be interacting regularly with the person. You know, I tend to hang towards 4 or 5 people in an interview process. I don't like it to be necessarily all day, because then everybody's tired and you're not seeing the best of what someone can bring forward. But I think, you know, a short list. I think 1's too small, 10's too many.
Sounds like buying china.
Yeah, exactly.
What you know, the other thing I've seen that fascinates me is the people we're interviewing are more aggressive about wanting information about the company. I mean, I'm assuming they're basically younger, and I see that not always being well received by, let's say, the more mature managers that might be interviewing them. They're not used to being interviewed.
And I think that's true. I think that there's so much information about companies out there. There's so much information, anecdotal things. If you look at websites like Glassdoor, you can go on Glassdoor and find out what other people, other candidates thought of their experience. So that just generates tons of questions. You know, you read that someone said they had a great interview with the accounting manager, answered all my questions. Well, you know what? You might softball a couple things. You read a review that said, had an interview with the accounting manager, they wouldn't answer anything. What's up with that? All of a sudden, you're coming with 10 questions, going like, ooh, what's yeah. going on here? But we have an information age. I'm glad people are, you know, asking questions. And you're right. It's, I think historically, interviewing has been a one side of the table adventure. You know, I ask you questions, you answer them, then I ask you the next one. But if you want an interactive employee who is going to share their opinions with you on the job, you should probably let them ask a few questions.
Yeah, you know, I kind of go back to more years back than I want to count out loud. But the first time I was interviewing somebody for a position, and they said, well, I'd like to see a copy of your financials. Now, this was, you know, my own company, wasn't maybe 30, 40 people at the time. And it just stopped me dead. It was like, well, what nerve you have asking to see our financials. Today, that wouldn't surprise me a bit.
Right. And I think some of that comes from some of the period that we just came out of, too. Right.
Yes.
We came out of a very uncertain economic period. A lot of companies struggled. So people are trying to assure themselves that, you know, you are who you say you are. Right.
Yeah.
So it is asked. It is asked. It's a right time and a wrong time to ask for it, but yeah, it's asked.
Do you spend much time on both sides of the table? I mean, most of the time, my impression is you're working for the company.
Yes.
Do you do much work with candidates?
I have definitely done some mentoring with new grads on how to interview, how to present yourself, what kind of questions and when. How to field typical questions from the employer, what to share, what is maybe not relevant, how to fix your Facebook page, things along
how to erase
line.
All those parties
how to
you
erase
went to.
All of those things.
You know, because I wonder really where people are getting their advice to help them. I mean, in my coaching, frequently I end up working with people at, let's say, middle to upper levels that are maybe exiting sometimes. And it's become so obvious that, well, if you had asked the right questions to begin with, you never would have wasted your time with this company. It wasn't a good fit. Never right. was a good fit. But you didn't ask the questions. You didn't.
Well, there's not a lot of education out there or readily available on how to interview. I mean,
yeah.
you could see things online and they're helpful. You can get advice from, you know, your best friend or your neighbor, and that may or may not be good advice. But it's a little difficult to sift through all of the information that is out there. But I think we're starting to see some of these tough questions that you're talking about. And, you know, it's like, you know, how healthy are you as a company? And where are you going? And what's the next step of growth for the company? New questions for candidates to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as they become more common, more and more people will also feel more comfortable asking them.
Well, look, we're going to shift gears after the commercial here in a minute, but before we do, what is the advice you would give a candidate today in interviewing?
I think the main advice I would give is what we've just talked about. Educate yourself. Know who you're interviewing with and what the company is doing. Look on their website. Look on, you know, if they're a publicly traded, look on Wall Street. Do your homework, right? And then be ready to talk about your accomplishments. I can read your resume. I don't need to know your list of job duties. I need to know what you did for that company. If you can articulate that, you're probably four or five steps ahead of most candidates.
Great advice. Okay, well, don't go away. We'll be right back. We're going to stop for a commercial here, and we'll be back. Okay, if you just joined us, welcome to the Coaching Perspective Radio Show. We've got Kathy Guiney here talking about HR from Yes HR Solutions. Kathy, great to have you back, and it's been a quick 20 minutes there.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thanks, Doug.
Well, look, one of the things you and I chatted about before we ever got on the air was job descriptions, which kind of stopped me dead when we were talking about what you'd talk about, and you said, well, job descriptions. I'm going, well, that's going to be interesting.
Okay, now you've set me up. I hope it's interesting. Job descriptions, it's been a really interesting couple of years because job descriptions in the past, and when I say past, I'm probably talking 5-6 years ago, were, you know, almost like a four-letter word. Nobody wanted to. Job description, it was a pain in the neck. It's just a piece of paper. I can hire as many people as I'd like. I'm bound to hire the right one somewhere along the way. As we went into tougher economic times, some companies had to be very selective. They couldn't hire five people anymore. They had to hire two. The need to describe what you wanted accomplished out of this position. And not so much what you wanted done, but what was the end result? What is the end result of hiring a test engineer? Not all of the day-to-day things they do. Sure, it's important to define those, but why are you hiring this person? And once you define why you're hiring them, then you kind of say, okay, well, I'm hiring them to do all of these things. And is it going to take up 40 hours? Is it 20 hours? Is it 120 hours and I should be hiring two people? So it really started to help define the needs as we went into a period of employment where there wasn't the luxury of hiring one more than I needed. You had to hire just what you needed. So what do you need? Now, there's obviously a compliance issue to job descriptions. It is still very, very important. It helps to determine whether they should be paid hourly or salaried. And, you know, so there's a very good reason on the compliance side of HR to have job descriptions. But it's now become a part of a strategic toolkit, defining what you need and how they're going to move the company forward. And that's just not relegated to the C-suite, folks. You know, someone who does who produces high volume, is productive, and, you know, has accomplishments that you need every day is moving the company forward, whether they're paid $40,000 or $240,000.
You know, and I want to tie this into something you said earlier, which we were talking about when people come in to be interviewed. Is the candidate able to explain what they really did for the company rather than run down their job description? You know, and in my mind, I kind of go to, the firefighter, the guy who's sitting down the street from me in the fire station. If we looked at his job description, it's probably full of a whole lot of not highly valuable things. You know, he makes breakfast for the crew once a week. They make the beds. They clean the yard. They wash the truck. But what he's really getting paid for is those 30 minutes of his experience in the middle of a fire where he's saving a life.
And he's calm. And he's calm, yeah, and collected and making good decisions under duress, under pressure. That's the job. There's tasks involved in getting there. And there's a really interesting job description format that really focuses more on outputs. Mm-hmm. What is the output of the time you're spending here at work today? Now, the how you do it, it's probably defined by some processes and things like that, right? But it's really about the output. And when you start to focus on that, it really makes things clear. Not only for the candidates, here is the result of your job. First of all, it gives them a purpose. Here is the result of your job. But it helps the employer to really, decide, is this what I need?
I see it on the other end. I see so often where I'm dealing with upper-level executives that are totally swamped. I mean, they've been with the company quite a period of time. They are looked at as the go-to person. They are putting in all kinds of hours. And yet, they're doing very little work at the level of what their pay is. They're very busy, full-time, but they've accumulated all of these tasks. And they're so busy. And sometimes I tell them, assume that you had to delegate 50% of your job away. What would you then do? And it's like, I'd go crazy. How could I sit here and do nothing? Well, the do nothing is what you're getting paid for. It's the thinking.
It's the output. It's the output.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily having four staff meetings a week, of which three haven't accomplished anything. It's the output. What is the output of a CEO job? What is it? And it's going to be a little different in every company, right? Maybe to some companies it's going to be strategic acquisitions. Maybe it's going to be, public relations at another company. But mm-hmm. What is the output? And generally it's not task-driven. You do the tasks to get to the output, and if those tasks don't lead you to that output, what the heck are you doing them for?
And my guess is that most of the time when somebody comes to the HR department and says, I need you to help me fill a position, they give you a job description that's full of tasks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you hired somebody that was capable of just doing those tasks, they wouldn't be the right person.
No, you would not have the output that you had hoped for. You'd have a lot of the administrative things done, perhaps, and maybe the meetings would be beautifully organized, but I'm not sure that you would have the output that you think you're paying for.
Yeah. I like that definition of job descriptions. I think we would... I don't know that I've seen one on paper that really gets to that.
I think it's a format that's coming into its own now. I have tried to introduce it to clients. Some of them embrace it. Some of them say, what the heck? Where are all the, makes copies and answers the phone and does all of that? I said, that doesn't need to be here.
Yeah. I've used job descriptions frequently in my coaching as a incremental. Rather than thinking of the job description as something that you're going to hire me to do today, the reality is that you wouldn't even trust me to do all those things today. So maybe it's going to be 2 years before I can take over this position completely. So what does my job description look like today? What's it going to look like in 90 days? What's it going to look like in 6 months, in a year? And that's an interesting exercise I found that makes people sort of look at output rather than just tasks.
Absolutely. And the job description shouldn't be static. Companies aren't static. If they are, they're not doing very well.
Right.
Companies are dynamic. Hopefully they're moving forward. And the job descriptions and the output need, could morph over time. So they shouldn't be the static thing that, if I have a 10-year career someplace, that the only job description or the only version is the one that I got on my first day. It hasn't kept up with me, right?
Right.
So it should not be a static piece of paper. It should be something that perhaps is inserted, in the performance management cycle.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about what you're really doing. Let's talk about the output we need for next year. How does that change some of the language in the job description?
Okay. Well, you made it interesting.
Phew, thanks.
I had no doubt. One of the things that continues to confuse me is the conflicting information about whether we have a shortage of people to hire, whether we have a surplus of people, whether there are jobs available or aren't jobs available. I mean, I read the paper, I look at the statistics, and you can just bend them almost any way you want. Let's sort of break it down. What is the market in the executive category?
Well, I think there's been something, from my observation anyway, that interesting that's happened at a senior level. That as we're coming out of the last couple years where things were a little tight and companies sadly went out of business or they downsized, they did whatever they were going to do to survive. Sometimes people of tenure ended up out of work. Sad. I think that those with a lot of skill started to reinvent themselves. And they kind of said, well, okay, this isn't good for me, so how do I use my skills in a different way? I think we've seen kind of a surgence of executives, senior-level people who are much more consultative-oriented now and willing to go to a variety of different companies to share their expertise. So if you're a smaller company looking for a CEO to come captive, it's not that there's necessarily fewer talented people out there. I think they may have reinvented themselves into a little different model that feels more secure to them. I'm controlling my own destiny now, and oh, look, I now get to work with four companies as opposed to one, and they want me to focus only on strategy, and I love that. So I think the candidate pool has changed. So it feels like there's less people.
Yeah, because the job description for the companies that are looking to fill positions probably haven't been changed.
Probably not. And it's like, I want someone who can do all things to all people.
And they need to be here all day.
All day.
Where I can see them.
Right.
So I know they're really working.
Right. And so I think that what we're seeing, I think, and we'll see how it all pans out, it seems like a model that's working quite well, is that we have companies that are establishing themselves as sort of outsourced CEO groups. So to your point you just made, that if really what I need is day-to-day someone to do somewhat tactical things, and then once a year we need someone to help us look at a strategic map for acquisition, it's probably not a 52-week job to do that. Go hire an expert. And they've been there, they've done that, they've been in this seat before. They're not, you know, someone who's not, you know, tested in a CEO role. They know how it works. So I think we're going into, I don't know if it's a flexible model necessarily. I think it's more about, you know, as I talked about, you know, what I like to talk about my company, it's the right resource at the right time. You don't always need, to the example I'm using, strategy 52 weeks out of the year. You might not need that. You might need it 6 weeks out of the year. So why don't you go get it the 6 weeks you need it?
You know, it's so sad. I've been on the other end with companies where we've interviewed candidates and then had a meeting to talk about the people we interviewed and had conversations like, you know, that guy is so bright. We really would like to have him, but we don't have enough here to keep him challenged and busy. He would quit after 6 months. And yet the conversation never comes up that, well, could we hire him one day a week, or could we hire him 1 week a month, or hire him, you know.
That's right. That's right.
So because we're locked into that, well, this is a full-time position we're recruiting for.
And I don't know if that's necessarily true anymore. I think there's probably more examples where it's not true. You know, and let's just look at, let's stop picking on our CEOs here, and let's look at maybe a finance role. I mean, you know what? How many acquisitions are you going to do most companies actually do a year?
Well, one would be a lot.
One would be a lot. So, you know, do you need a CFO who's gifted in doing an acquisition 52 weeks out of the year? Maybe not. You need a CFO who's gifted in running accounts payable and the controller and the VP of finance or whatever else other disciplines you have under the CFO. But that targeted laser focus on an acquisition, that's probably someone you want to tag on the shoulder and say, we know you, we respect you, why don't you come in and give us a hand?
Mm-hmm.
Or, to your point, it's, you know, 1 week every 6 weeks. You're in here, and we're talking, we're meeting, we're looking at what we want to do. May not be full time.
You know, the other thing that I see contributing to this isn't just the people that were displaced in the job market, but we're also looking at the, I'm going to say, the baby boomer segment that is reaching the point when they don't want to work full time, but they still want to work.
Yeah. And, yes. They have to, unless they're going to live in their folks' basement for the rest of their lives.
But they're looking for that flex situation.
I think that, you know, the generations of folks coming into the workforce now are folks that appreciate a variety of things in the day. They're not going to sit at a desk 8 hours. They want to go to the gym, they want to come in, they want to do something for a while, they want to go outside and walk around and do some text messaging, come back in, then they'll do something else. That doesn't mean, and again, if we focus on the output,
yeah,
do we actually care? You know, historically we have, and it's very hard to break the notion that if they're not here, they must not be doing stuff, right? They're out doing whatever it is, you know, they're hot rodding their car or getting it detailed or whatever. Do we care, really, as long as the output's there?
Yeah. I sat in a meeting this week with it was a very long, very strenuous meeting where the staff of the company had been told, we have a crisis, you need to put in 60 hours. They weren't told what the output was needed.
You could put in 60 hours and still not get them what they thought they were asking you for.
Absolutely. Interesting. Okay, we're going to take a quick break here, and then we're going to come right back. We'll deal with the other end of the spectrum, the 35 and under market group. So. Okay, and we're back here. We've been talking about the executive market, but Kathy, what about the 35 and under market? Give us a snapshot of what that looks like.
Well, I think that we have to embrace the fact that some of the workers coming into the workforce have a little bit of different perspective than perhaps you and I had in our careers. The days of expecting an employee to come in and give you long tenure, I think those are becoming an exception. I think that those people that are, you know, Gen X, a five-year tenure is what we expect to see on a resume. You start to get into the millennials, and it's 18 months, or certainly no more than 3 years.
Wow.
But again, it depends upon how you define what you want from these employees, right? 18 months of someone who is outstanding at what they do has probably moved the company forward incrementally further. Now you have the disruption of people being nomadic and moving about. But I think that if you look at resumes these days, you know, it's not unusual to find people moving 18 to 24 months. Now, when I look at it from my perspective in my career, I'm going like, oh my gosh, you know, because I was at places 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years. Maybe that's not the norm anymore. You know, you look at our average merit increase, 3%. 3%'s not going to buy you a house anytime soon.
Nope.
So maybe there is also a very practical side of changing jobs, which is there's still upside to be made by changing a job. Sign-on bonuses are resurging. So you get a sign-on bonus, and someone's probably going to give you a little bit of bump on salary. So you start to look at some practical sides of job switching also. Again, we go back to the disruption factor, perhaps. So what do we do? Companies cannot just unlimitedly give employees money. You have to pay them fairly, no doubt about that. But money can't be the only reason that you have a chance of holding on to somebody. If you want to break this 18-month tenure and turn it into 4 years, why are people working? What is it that you can offer them? You can't offer them, you know, 12% increases a year. No, it's not going to happen. So what else you got? What else you got that's going to, you know, hook them and make them want to be with you? I did an article in the OC Business Journal 2 weeks ago, and it was kind of along that theme. It was, you know, look, boss, we won the lottery. And it's really about, what do you do if money's not the hook? What do you do? And there's lots of articles out there. Daniel Pink did a TED Talk on this. And it's about finding the value that everyone has in their job. What makes it valuable to them? Is it giving presentations to the CEO? Is it being part of a project team? Is it, to the point we made before the break, being able to go get my car washed at lunch? Sometimes it's small things. Employees don't necessarily need a parade every time that they want something. Sometimes it's simple things that employers miss. It's like, why are they here? Defining the purpose, we go all the way back around to the output of the job. What is the purpose of me being here? It can't possibly be to file these things. That doesn't mean anything to me. What is the purpose of me doing? Why am I doing this? You start to be able to define that, and maybe you have a reason for people to come back. You see a lot of companies' websites changing. And I think it's kind of interesting. The landing pages, now I'm not talking the career pages, the landing pages are people-oriented.
Yeah.
They will show happy people. They'll show people doing biking together and people doing things together. And at charities, they're building houses and they're doing all kinds of things together. And it's all about adding value beyond your salary. If you're here, look at all of this camaraderie and all the cool things that we're going to allow you to do while you're here. You're adding value that's not necessarily in a paycheck. So I think that is certainly the challenge coming up with our younger workers. It's like, I can't offer you unlimited salary. So what do I got? And it's going to cause employers to really think about, what do they have? And how are they communicating it? I mean, employees can't just, you know, stumble over it. You have to explain it. It has to be transparent. It has to be real. It just can't be lip service. It has to be actually real. And is it what they want? Just because I think they want it doesn't mean they do.
Well, and you're talking about a challenge that is more individual.
It is very individual.
So you're not talking about a standard solution that can be applied to everybody in this department. It's got to be applied on an individual basis.
And that's a mind shift too.
Yeah.
Because we are kind of an employment society that says I have to treat everybody the same. Now, it's difficult because some of our laws say be careful by treating people differently. But there's still got to be a way to do it, right? You don't need to break laws. You don't need to do any of that discriminatory stuff. But there's still room to have something that means something to that employee. And it's, like I said, it's not parades and balloons. It's brass. It's not brass bands. It's usually small things.
You know, I was fortunate enough to spend 7 years with the Irvine Company from 70 to 77. And during that time, my impression was we had like zero turnover. There probably was some, but it wasn't noticeable. Right after the company sold, there was maybe 100% turnover, huge turnover. Not because of anything wrong with the new company, but because that what had kept people there was the camaraderie.
Yeah.
They did not pay well. They did not provide a lot of fringe. They provided a few unique benefits. You know, you could go out in the fields and pick the corn when it was fresh. You could go to a barbecue out with the cowboys. I mean, you know, there were some things that were unique about working for a company that was still in the ranching business that they took advantage of. They were smart enough to use those things and make them available to the employees, and they appealed to a lot of people. a lot of people stayed because they were personally being challenged at a level that they couldn't get anyplace else. Building a new city that was really state of the art. Okay. So there was a lot of things that were done, none of which had to do with money.
That's right.
Which had to do with money.
You know, there's generally three things that employers should take a look at. You know, it's like how can you give an employee the ability to direct themselves? I'm not saying we want, renegade people running about, but what in their job can you give them authority for? Of how they do it.
Right.
Right? You want them to feel they're learning. Nobody wants to be stagnant. So what skills am I mastering? What are those things? And then they need to feel that what they're doing means something.
Appreciated.
And if you can find the unique thing for every employee or groups of employees on those things, you probably have a good chance of creating an environment where I get paid okay, but I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what you hope for, because it goes all the way back around, because if you love what you do, I know this has been said 95 million times, if you love what you do, you'll do better at it.
Yeah, your performance goes up.
So,
absolutely.
So the company
everybody
gets the
benefits.
Output, and everybody gets the output, it's all good.
Well, okay, so that's the challenge with the under 35. Well, look, we've talked about a lot of things here today. Anything that I've kind of talked over you on, or that we skipped past, that you want to revisit before we wrap up?
You know, I think, we have covered everything, I think, that sort of fits under these topics here. And I guess I would just say that I think we're in a time where we need to be, as employers, almost brave enough to break the norm. Employment in 2014 is not, or work in 2014 is not the same as it was in 2004 or 2010 or even 2012. So I think that it's, as employers, we need to not be afraid to kind of look around the corners and say, should I be doing this differently?
Okay. So Kathy, let me put you on the spot here. We didn't rehearse this. Who out there, what company, what individual out there should be calling you?
Well, my goodness. I would hope that small to mid-sized companies that really want to go to the next level or figure out how to stage themselves to do that, love to hear from them. I like to work, as you can tell, because I have found, my output is directly related to my clients and helping them achieve everything from something that's very simple to, how do we, construct a compliant HR file, as simple as it can be, to how do we go to China and talk to people about change. So that's kind of what I'm all about and what I love to do.
I love it, and it shows. How do people get in touch with you?
Well, they can go to the website, which is www.yeshrsolution.com. They can find me on LinkedIn or on Facebook at YesHR Solution.
Great. Kathy, well, thank you very much
for
revisiting us, and I look forward to you coming back again.
Great.
It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we've been talking with Kathy Guiney about HR, and I hope that you have gotten something out of it. I certainly have learned a lot, but then again, I start off in a negative position, so it's real easy to fill my bucket. I hope you've enjoyed the show today. The discussion has provided you with new ideas and information that you can use to identify and achieve your goals. Have a great evening.
You've been listening to the one show that takes a look at business from a different perspective, the coaching perspective, with Master Certified Business Coach Doug Gefeller.